This is Sportsnet Today, and you're on air with Israel Fair and Alex Blair. Now here are your hosts, Israel and Alex.
All right, Sportsnet Today is on air. Israel Fair, Alex Blair, producer Josh Elliott Wolf with us as well. Before we dive into our headline segment, we are looking for some questions at around 12:30. We will be going through a bit of a mailbag. We've gotten a few submissions on Twitter. You can still tweet us, but you can also text in those submissions at 650-650, and we will read them live on the show. We've also got a book to give away. A few weeks ago, we had Jeff Benedict, author of The Dynasty, a book about the New England Patriots and their 20-year run with Robert Kraft as the owner, Bill Belichick as the head coach, and Tom Brady as the quarterback. His deep dive, very insightful, lots of interesting anecdotes about an unprecedented dynasty, especially in that sport. So we do have a copy of that book. We will pick a submission from one of the questions and get in touch with that person. And they want the book. It's all theirs. So that's easy. Send us some questions. And like I said, we've got about half an hour live here to get those to us. And also, we're going to have Brian Burke on just after 1 o'clock. He's got a new book out as well, a book about his life in hockey, Berkey's Law. And so we're really looking forward to talking to Brian about his life in hockey, his time in Vancouver. He's led an interesting and varied experience through hockey. And so I look forward, and Alex and I, we look forward to that conversation. All right, let's dive into the headlines. It's been pretty quiet the last couple of days, but since we last had our show, the Canucks managed to swing a big move. It was one that you actually, on the show last week, thought was quite possible. I think this guy was at the top of the list in terms of defensemen that the Canucks could get. So they did end up pulling off a trade for Nate Schmidt after Vegas signed Alex Pietrangelo, had to make a cap move, and for the cost of a third-round pick, the Canucks got a guy that is pretty universally accepted as a top-four D-man, a guy that can play on a first pair, a guy that can play 20 minutes a night, and be an impactful player at 5-on-5. So you were pretty high on what the Canucks didn't do the first couple of days of free agency in terms of some big contracts to existing players that have now left. And as much as that kind of caused some frustration within the fan base, the Schmidt trade seemed to turn that a little bit. So I'll ask you, Alex, are you even more optimistic or encouraged on the Canucks and their offseason than you were when we spoke last week?
Well, I was happy the Nate Schmidt deal came to fruition, and I was pleasantly surprised at the fact that Canucks only had to give up a third-round pick. We talked last week about the cap realities and the pressure that we're going to likely face Las Vegas, especially considering the interest in Alex Pietrangelo, and we also chatted about the cap pressures that are existing in Tampa Bay, and that there was probably going to be an opportunity. I was pleasantly surprised that the Canucks were able to effectively upgrade their defense. His cap hit, I think, is just under $6 million, 5.8, 5.9, but he's under term for 5 years. So when you think about what Chris Tanev got in Calgary at 4.5, you're getting, I think it's widely considered that Nate Schmidt is an upgrade for the Canucks in their top four. The Canucks were looking to try and move Chris Tanev down to a bottom pairing defenseman. And at this stage of Tanev's career, that's probably on a winning team. That's where Tanev would likely fill out. So, I still think it's a really unique offseason. I still think there are going to be good players that shake free. I know the immediate reaction has been a little disappointing in Vancouver when you look at what Troy Stetcher signed for in Detroit. And I know this has been said, but Troy Stetcher was not going to sign that deal in Vancouver. He may have signed that weeks ago, but the Canucks were not in a position to commit that kind of money while they were sorting things out. And I think from talking to a few people this week, Tyler Toffoli did not expect to take a deal like that either. But the forward market cratered very quickly in these sort of unprecedented times. And I think Tyler kind of had to realize that he was probably not going to get as high per year as he thought he did. And he He jumped at 4.25 over 4 years in Montreal. Again, I don't think that if the Canucks had offered that 2 weeks ago, I think he would have turned that down. So, To be honest, I still feel like Canucks are in a good spot. I think the Canucks, I'll be interested to see what happens in Tampa Bay. There's been chat. They've got two RFAs on the defense, Mikhail Sergachev and Eric Cernak. I think more likely Cernak could be a fit at his cap hit for the Canucks. But I also think there's going to be other players that shake free here for the Canucks. And they're still, you know, as Bill Foley said this week, the owner of the Las Vegas Golden Knights, who knows when we will be playing again. So that's my read on the Canucks sort of quieter week this week.
Yeah, I look at that market and the point is a good one, that those forwards, and Tyler Toffoli is a good player and he has been a solid player. He showed that he fit really well with the Canucks top players. And then obviously going back to, you know, the early years of his career with a Kings team that won the Stanley Cup, that was not an offensive dynamo, but got timely goals and was able to produce offense when they needed to now being, you know, a little bit older, but still a solid player. But those players definitely were the ones, especially the forwards, that I think are most impacted and hurt by the market right now. They have, especially because, look, the Canucks were not the only team that thought that they needed to upgrade their defense. I mean, you look at the Calgary Flames signing Chris Tanev, the Toronto Maple Leafs signing TJ Brody. You go across the board. I think most teams thought we need to upgrade our defense. And I think, and don't quote me on this, but it feels like that there are more NHL-ready prospect forwards in teams' pipelines right now. I mean, we're just coming off a draft that was quite forward-heavy. Not that these players are necessarily going to jump into the NHL right now, but there's just the feeling that the last few years has been quite heavy on forwards and that there's teams, maybe like the Canucks, thinking, okay, well, maybe one of our recent draft picks or maybe one of our prospects can get a role in a top nine and play productively at a low cap hit, but we want to invest with our defensemen. And I mean, if you followed the Canucks the last few years, that is pretty obvious that at times the team has lacked defense. When the team has struggled the most, it's when they've had serious injuries on their defense or the defensemen simply haven't been performing. To me, it's very much like baseball, where you can't have enough pitchers in baseball, in hockey, in the NHL especially. You can't have enough defensemen, especially high-end defensemen. And so I look at the Schmidt over Tanev move as an upgrade as well, and think that they got there eventually. It didn't seem like the course of a couple days that they were going to be able to do that, but that was their big priority this offseason, to get a top four defenseman. They got one. I look forward to seeing what kind of pairings they're going to put together, because the four guys that would be in that mix are an interesting fit, to say the least, with Quinn Hughes, Alex Edler, Tyler Myers, and Nate Schmidt. Do you do Hughes-Myers? I know we talked about that last week. That was something that you weren't necessarily super high on. But is Hughes-Schmidt a better option? Or it's going to be interesting to see how they try to cater to Hughes, how they try to cater to Edler, which is not even strictly a production and performance thing at this point. That's also a minutes dispersal decision, an older player, a guy who doesn't need to be playing the 20 plus minutes that he has in the past. And it'll be interesting. I think that there's possibly another move coming. I mean, we saw Myers play with Oscar Fantenberg a lot last season. That was not a prototypical top four pairing, but Myers got shifts with Quinn Hughes, depending on situations, got shifts with Alex Edler, depending on situations. So it'll be interesting to see if he remains in that wild card role. But at the end of the day, Nate Schmidt is an upgrade for this team. And he did light the world on fire with his press conference or his Zoom call with reporters, as well as a great personality. I know fans felt that the team lost some pretty decent guys. Chris Tanev had been here for a very long time and had established himself inside the community in the dressing room. Jacob Markstrom as well, really developed into being a leader and a face for and a voice for this team. And Troy Stetcher was the hometown kid who I think loved being a Canuck maybe more than anybody that's ever played for this team. So to have a guy come in that's got personality, that is really excited to join this group, is reminiscent of JT Miller, who maybe didn't
come out of the box. He doesn't have the same outward personality as Nate Schmidt does. But once he got here and he realized what it would be like to be around Elias Pettersson and Quinn Hughes every day and Bo Horvat, Brock Besser, and the rest of that group, was really excited for that opportunity. And so that'll be for me kind of the first steps, though. Like you just said, if Bill Foley said it and they don't know when they're coming back, we sure don't know when they're coming back either.
No, and I think the other thing that I like about the Schmidt deal is, you know, in a year's time, Alex Edler is going to be up. And, you know, whether they can sort of, you know, inch along with Edler and get him to sign another short-term deal, who knows? But there's another player that potentially could walk or price himself out of a top four role. So, you know, you have Quinn Hughes, who's just at the beginning of his career. But getting Nate Schmidt at the term you do, you know, at least, you know, if you lose Edler in a year, you've got two of your top 4D. I'm still a big believer that on a winning team, Tyler Myers is probably a 5 or a 6. So, you know, they've committed the money that they have to him. It's probably, well, it's not probably, it is more than he probably should be making against the cap. And if you look at the Canucks, that's their biggest issue and concern is just the amount of money they've committed to players that are, you know, lower down in the lineup, whether it's on defense or on forward. You touched on JT Miller. I want to ask you, there was a notable signing yesterday in the NHL with Joe Thornton after 15 years in San Jose, signing a 1-year $700,000 deal in Toronto. Do you like this move for the Leafs? Are they better? And if so, why?
I do like it. It's kind of the philosophy that there's no such thing as a bad 1-year contract. It's a cheap 1-year contract at that. And Joe Thornton is a player that still has some special teams, specifically power play utility. And if you watch the Leafs at all the last couple of years, you see the talent. The high-end Austin Matthews is about as good a goal scorer as anybody in the league. Mitch Marner had a bit of a down year, but was still a guy that when he's got the puck on his stick can be a great playmaker, make things happen. John Tavares is kind of a mix of the two and a guy that is, you know, he's probably the highest end kind of garbage man goal scorer, to say the least. Not that he's a hugely skilled player and he can score it in a lot of ways, but when he's really productive, he's incredible in front of the net. On a power play, he's very strong playing behind the net as well and creating and making plays from that standpoint. But the Leafs stalled out on the power play every once in a while, and now they're bringing in a guy who is among the all-time best players in that kind of role. He's not expected to carry a first unit. You look at him as a player that can be a big part of a second unit. And he, like I said, he's one of the best to ever do it, right? I think that's sort of, it's what the Canucks almost expected in certain respect from Michael Ferland, specifically on that power play role, a guy that could play on the second unit, be a bit of a playmaker. But Joe Thornton is Joe Thornton, and Michael Ferland is a guy that the Canucks had high hopes for as a bit more of an all-around player that wasn't going to have the same type of production that Joe Thornton might have. And they've built the bottom six out of kind of local guys, Jason Spezza, who re-signed, and they also signed Wayne Simmonds to cheap contracts with very defined roles of what these players are going to be, did not commit term, which is why the bottom six in Vancouver always is under attack, because it's a lot of that term. It's signing someone to a 4-year deal to play fourth line center. It's not great business. And when you're talking about Joe Thornton going to Toronto, a team that as much as it's easy to criticize them and say that you know, some of the young players haven't fulfilled expectations and things like that, if you just look at the way that they've played the last couple of years, there are some tangible holes that they can address on the margins. And one of them is that second power play unit. And Thornton's going to have a role there. It'll be interesting to see kind of how they make those lines work at 5-on-5 with some of those older players in that bottom six. But look, yeah, it'll be interesting, right? I mean, this is different than the Patrick Marleau contract that he signed there, because that was term. And while the first year went relatively well, it kind of tailspin quickly after that. So the expectations aren't super high, but he still provides value even as the oldest guy in the league.
I'm curious to see how they use Spezza and Thornton. That was my only concern with the deal, but I would agree. I think the Toronto Maple Leafs needed something in the locker room, and I like the deal. Right now, I'm sort of thinking it's a wash on the ice. I don't think it's negative, but I'm not sure how positive it's going to be directly on the ice. But what I think Joe will bring, if you talk to anyone, and I was fortunate enough to spend some time in San Jose during the playoffs, Joe is a large personality, and he carries some swagger, and he really can set the tone in the locker room. And I think he will help the maturation process for Austin Matthews, Mitch Marner. I think he will buffer them a little bit, but I think he will also help them handle the pressure cooker that is Toronto and has become, you know, the temperature has been ratcheted up in the last few years as this sort of young, exciting core group has not been able to get through the first round. So switching to baseball, we've got a couple of big games today, potential elimination games. Before we were off the air at 1:30, the NLCS game six is going between Atlanta and LA with Atlanta up 3-2. Does this series end tonight, Izzy, or are we going to see a game seven?
I feel like we're going to see a game seven. I had that game on last night, and the Dodgers are still, to me, top to bottom, the best team in baseball. They would be in this series if not for another unfortunate playoff start from Clayton Kershaw. And I feel like they've been the best team in baseball the whole season, and that they've got another game in them. I hope it goes seven, because these are fun teams to watch, the Braves and the Dodgers. They match up well with each other. It's been a fun series in a different way than the other series, which is crazy to look back at. The looked like Tampa, who had probably been the best team in the American League all season, was going to roll to the World Series, and everyone was pretty happy about that because they were going to knock out Houston, who's definitely. It's crazy to say, right? They're more unpopular than the Yankees. And that, like, no one ever figured that would happen. It's very hard to believe that there is a team that's currently more unpopular than the Yankees. And these are Yankee teams that are pretty good. This is a Yankees core that's made the playoffs and hasn't won a championship in a while now. But the Astros are the most unpopular team in that sport, maybe the most unpopular team in sports. They still have a couple of pretty good players, and they've been able to put it together and send that to game seven, which is also later tonight. So it's been a weird baseball season. I'm a big baseball fan, but it's been disjointed at the best of times. But these are interesting matchups, and I'm particularly compelled by the one in the National League.
Yeah, and if you're interested in roster construction, there is a terrific article. I'll tweet it out in the Wall Street Journal today by Jared Diamond, looking at Andrew Friedman, who is the sort of executive and general manager, if you will, with the Los Angeles Dodgers, and his connection with basically the four executives that are running the last four teams alive in baseball. And the connection right now in the series that he's playing is with Alex Anthopoulos, former Blue Jays general manager, who he hired in LA after Alex departed the Blue Jays. Alex was there for a few years and now is in Atlanta, obviously. Anyway, it's a really fascinating article. It shows that when he left Wall Street to take on the GM role in Tampa, he hired a couple of interns who have now gone on to become sort of general managers around baseball as well, in Boston, in Houston, and in Tampa. So we'll poke that as well. And Houston was down 3-0 in that series. And as you touched on, Izzy, I'm not sure there is a more hated team. So just before we, you know, finish up the opening segment, wanted to ask you about the NFL. Raja mentioned at the top of the hour in the update that the Jacksonville Jaguars have announced that a practice squad player has tested positive. The Denver Broncos released this morning that their running backs coach has tested positive. And as we've been on the air here, the Baltimore Ravens have announced that defensive tackle Brandon Williams is now been put on the reserve COVID-19 list. As a football fan, are you comfortable with what the NFL is doing and how they are going about their business? And would you feel differently if you lived in one of the markets where the NFL teams currently reside?
The first thing I'll say is that I'm not surprised at the way that the NFL has handled this. This is very part and parcel with the way that they go about their business on touchier subjects, more sensitive subjects. If they address things, they tend to be very ham-handed. And when they don't, which is generally the way that they go about things, it is kind of just try to case-by-case basis. They don't go kind of blanket policies and things like that. And so the one thing that doesn't sit well with me, and I think that through the first month or so of the season, it's gone relatively well. It's not like there's been a massive, massive outbreak, multiple teams and things like that. They have taken some precautions by rescheduling games, postponing games, doing things like that. To hear the Tennessee Titans talk about the adversity that they have gone through and that people counted them out because they had a bit of a COVID outbreak is quite on the money for the NFL and some of the tone deafness. But as a fan, I think the product has still been at a high level. I mean, just mostly watching the Seahawks, and they haven't been directly affected by any of these COVID situations yet. It's been in a bit of a better place, I suppose, than I anticipated. Because I'll be honest, I did brace for the worst. Where are you at quickly on the way that it's played out?
I'll say this. I mean, I think I would feel different if I lived in one of the cities that was potentially going to be affected, if I had family members or loved ones. Right now, we haven't seen any direct linkage between the NFL players and coaches and any of their testing positive with outbreaks in the communities. But I think that the narrative would shift very quickly if that was to happen. I just look at it from the standpoint that, you know, it's taken on a huge part of the oxygen for the NFL. You know, this week we've got Tom Brady versus Aaron Rodgers on Sunday, which, you know, typically would be a lot of the conversation leading into the weekend. You touched on the Seahawks, you know, an unbelievable start for Russell Wilson and their group 5-0. I don't know. I will say, I think subconsciously, I don't love what the NFL has done. I think they've sort of just looked out for themselves. And I think deep down, it sort of shifted my opinion of the NFL to a degree, but I'm not seeing it on sort of a daily basis. It's more of just the tone. But I think this started for me with, you know, the kneeling for the anthem and how the owners, you know, did not acknowledge the players or support them in that sense. I just think there's been a sort of a really sort of political cloud that's hung over the NFL. So anyway, those are my thoughts. So.
All right. We are going to keep the show rolling. You can text us 650-650 if you've got any questions for us. We do have a few on Twitter. So coming up next, we'll take those questions. We'll probably run through a few headlines as well, and we'll keep you up to date if there's any news on what's going on in the world of sports. We'll do that next. This is On Air with Israel Fair and Alex Blair on the home of the Canucks, Sportsnet 650.
It's time for Sportsnet Today. This is On Air with Israel Fair and Alex Blair on your home of the Canucks, Sportsnet 650.
On Air rolls on, Sportsnet 650, Sportsnet Today. I'm Israel Fair here with Alex Blair and producer Josh Elliott Wolf. We've got a few questions from the audience, from our listeners that we'll answer here. You can always text us at 650-650. When we're alive during the show, and we love your feedback. We had a lot of fun last week closing out the show with a lot of feedback. I mean, lots of news for our show last week, coming off the first day of free agency. But we're open to your feedback all the time. We'd love to hear from you. So if you can text us live, 650-650, or you can find us on Twitter as well, and let us know what you think. Your takes, reactions, opinions, and also just general feedback. If there's anything that you want to know about us, about our guests, we're pretty much an open book. So why don't we start here, Alex? Let's go to this. This is the first question that we got yesterday. And it ties in with what you were talking about earlier in Bill Foley speculating about the 2020-2021 NHL season, how that might look. So the question is, Bettman says the NHL season will start Jan 1. Bill Foley speculated it could be as late as Feb 1 with as few as 48 games. How does the start date affect cap penalties coming into effect and a myriad of other behind-the-scenes things? I know that you're aware of what Bill Foley said, so I'll give the floor to you to start. And you're also got a pretty good grasp at this point in talking to people. We've been making a concerted effort to pay attention to what's going on behind the scenes with some organizations. We have paid attention to what's gone on with the Canucks, who had some layoffs in the summer, still appear to be headed toward that situation as well. And that is not unique to Vancouver. That's been a kind of across the league. And then also just specifically how this salary cap situation is impacting teams in the short term, which we have seen to a certain extent through free agency. But I do think it's the long-term implications that that are going to linger more than just a certain number of free agents not getting quite the contracts that they thought they might get.
When I look at next season, I think the biggest factor is the U.S. television deal. There is 1 year left on NBC's national television agreement. It was a 10-year deal, and it brings in a substantial amount of revenue for the league. And prior to COVID-19, they were expecting a large increase and multiple American broadcasters, media companies bidding. And there was a sense that Bettman would sort of change from the past where they had been exclusively with NBC. There was a sense going forward that they would maybe break the package up sort of the way the NFL does. And, you know, there was a thought that NBC would still be involved, but ESPN was looking to get back in. Would they maybe start to take a step in the new direction and go with, you know, an Amazon TV or YouTube TV or something to that capacity? The biggest direct effect on next year is there's a certain amount of games that they have to play to fulfill the contractual obligation of that television contract. And so it's a question whether Bettman wants to do that. And my feeling is that he would. He'd want to get through this year so that they can get a new injection of money from a new broadcast deal. However, as we've seen with television ratings, they have been down. The advertising market has been decimated by COVID-19. I am curious to see if there's any reason that Gary would think, let's put a season in place that doesn't satisfy the contract so that he buys himself another year to when there's a better landscape to sign a new national television contract. I think that that's probably a less likely scenario. I think the more likely scenario is that they will play the required amount of games. I don't know what that is, but it is in writing in the contract, and that they'll be able to get an injection of new TV money for the U.S. And in theory, that will help rebound the cap quicker. It's probably the biggest revenue source outside of fans being allowed back in the arenas that the NHL can hope for in the near future. So that would be the thing that I would keep an eye on. I know there's a couple of regional television contracts that are currently up. I know both Calgary and Edmonton, their regional deals with Sportsnet ended at the end of this year. They are quietly in negotiations behind the scenes. Word I have heard is that Edmonton was asking for a lot, and that both TSN and Sportsnet were not prepared to go there. That was the last word I had on that. And Calgary's an interesting one. I'm actually in Calgary today, and Calgary has one radio station in town. It's a Sportsnet radio station. They have been a Sportsnet station for quite a while. But, you know, in the new landscape, the NHL and their clubs are looking for as much money, if not more, than the last deal. And yet broadcasters are seeing ratings and advertising going the other way. So it's a tricky dance at the moment. So that's the biggest immediate impact when I look at the schedule for next season. We know NBC has the Olympic rights as well for what was supposed to be the 2020 Summer Olympics in Tokyo. Those have been pushed to next summer. But at this point, I think it's fair to say that we're not sure whether those Olympics will go forward at this point.
Right. And that's the biggest thing hanging over the TV contract part. And I think the NHL, at least publicly, has spoken in pretty strong terms that they've been happy, especially recently, with their partnership with NBC. That doesn't mean that they wouldn't open it up. I think it would be in the NHL's best interest to look at something like an Amazon or a YouTube TV and try to diversify that way. to reach a different audience and to maybe make some of those games more accessible in the United States. I don't know if people in Canada realize that due to Sportsnet's packaging and if you have Center Ice and stuff, then obviously you have access to a bunch of the games, but that there are a number of games that are broadcast here outside of market. Obviously in Vancouver, we get all the Canucks games via Sportsnet now. But in the States, it is different. It's a different national arrangement than it is in Canada, where we have the institution of Saturday night, and then we have added a number of national games, whether it be hometown hockey or Wednesday night hockey or a few other marquee games that might be spread out during the week. That's not the case in the United States, and that's a big decision. Though I do think one of the interesting parts, and you just brought it up, is the ratings for sports right now being in an interesting place, because there was some optimism heading into the bubble that the NHL might explore extending their season a little bit to avoid the NFL, see what a summer audience might be like. Not the best circumstances. Obviously, this is not just a let's give this a shot. There are still a lot of things going on in the average person's day-to-day life that are completely unrelated to the NHL and might have a certain impact on the ratings. But at the end of the day, in this country and in the United States, the ratings were not gangbusters. So there is probably an incentive to get back to something closer to the regularly programmed NHL schedule that we're all used to.
Yeah, and as we touched on with the Olympics, I think the Olympics are scheduled to start July 23rd, and if they go ahead, NBC would need the NHL season to be wrapped up at that point. So, you know, the NHL has acknowledged optimistically at this point, which I think is still very optimistic, they're looking now at January 1st as the start of that. So you're looking at starting January 1st, which is already 3 months into what a regularly scheduled season would be. Usually you're dropping the puck sort of October 5th to October 7th. So you're 3 months behind that. And, you know, a typical season is usually wrapping up the second week of June. So you're adding on only a month. So you're losing about 2 months, if they can start January 1st, of season availability. So it's already going to be a compressed schedule. It's going to be reduced games. How much, you know, because I know they don't want to alter the playoffs. This year was such a unique one, but I think they want to keep the integrity of the four rounds in the playoffs. So, you know, they've done, you know, as recently as 2013, we saw them do 48 games when they had the labor dispute. So it's not unprecedented, but, you know, the NHL is going to be patient. I think they're going to wait and see how this unfolds. They do not want to commit to any plans because it's such a fluid situation. But the U.S. television contract is the one that I think within the league and behind the scenes, everybody's keeping an eye on, because there was an expectation that it would maybe double or triple in value from the previous deal that NBC had signed. I think that deal was signed in 2010. But obviously the landscape has changed significantly. And I would say a lot of industries have been deeply affected by the pandemic. I would say the television broadcasting industry has been one of the ones hit significantly. So.
All right, we will move on to a couple questions that we've got in the inbox about some Canucks roster machinations. The first one we'll get to, and this is the question for us: what price would you pay to get rid of the final year of Brandon Sutter's contract? Is a second round pick too much? So a second round pick is a sweetener. What about Cole Lind? I think if you look at the Canucks right now, there's still maybe some optimism within the fan base that a buyout might be a possibility as the second window will open. Brandon Sutter seems like the obvious candidate because of the way his contract is structured. It is a 1 year. There's a 1 year left on his deal at this point. If there's going to be a trade, in terms of a sweetener, I think a second round pick is probably a bit much. Especially if the return is not a player that's going to have an impact on this team, be a top nine option Canucks fans might not be all that high on Brandon Sutter and what he brings to the table. We saw some flashes during the playoffs that he still can be an effective and productive player at 5-on-5, and certainly has a role on the penalty kill. But I think that, you know, the injuries over the course of the last 4 or 5 years have taken a toll on some of his better skills, his skating in particular, where when he got here was probably an average to above average NHL skater, and now there's probably some questions there, and certainly not getting off the shot like he did his first year here and going back through his NHL career. So I do think when you look at the Canucks, and while they did make the move for Nate Schmidt and take on a pretty significant salary commitment going forward, if they're looking at this year in particular, it might be in their best interest at this point to let that contract run out, see if Brandon Sutter has anything left to provide the team, if there is the ability for him to capture some of what we saw in the Minnesota series, a little bit of the St. Louis series, and be a guy that the expectations are not that he's going to be a second or third line center anymore. That's for sure.
Yeah, I would be hesitant to give up a second round pick. The Canucks have been able to get a lot of value out of the second round. Cole Lind is an interesting one because I would put Cole in sort of the second tier of prospects. I don't think he's sort of pushing to make this roster next year. And I think there's obviously players, whether it be Hoglander or Podkolzin, that are ahead of him. So if you're asking me between those two options, I would lean more to adding Cole Lind as a sweetener and keeping the second round pick. But when you look at the Canucks situation, you know, next year, you know, they've got 1 year left with Brandon Sutter. So can you stomach the 4.3? It's coming off the cap next year. You've got Tanner Pearson's 3.7 million coming off the cap next year. Sten Berchi's 3.3 comes off the cap next year. And then on defense, you've got Alex Edler's 6 million and Jordy Benn also coming off the cap at 2 million. So, you know, buying out Brandon Sutter is going to save you about 2.1 this year, but it's also going to add 2.1 next year. It's going to take his $4.3 million salary. It'll cut it in half this year, but it'll put the other half into next year. So I think I agree with you, Izzy. I think you either can ride it out with Brandon this year if you don't buy him out, or given the options from the submission, I would include Cole Lind over a second round pick.
And we've got another related question. Do you think the Canucks will sign Jake Virtanen and buy out either Louis Erickson or Sutter? So we just covered Sutter there for the most part. I mean, the thought earlier in the window about buying out Sutter and clearing a little bit of cap room was that the Canucks would be able to take advantage of that and make multiple moves in free agency and be aggressive and try to supplement and complement some of the top players. And it's quite obvious at this point that outside of coming depth moves, we'll get to the Jake Virtanen part of that question in a second. Outside of some of the upcoming depth moves of people that are outside of the organization, clearing that $2 million this year is not going to make a world of difference. Even if they could go and get a player that might be more impactful than Brandon Sutter at $2 million instead of what Brandon Sutter is being paid for to provide at $4 million+. It's the market did not bear that out for the Canucks, and the Canucks made a priority to go and get a top four defenseman, which they did accomplish. On Jake Virtanen, that is something to watch. I know that's something that you've talked about since we've had the show on the air, that might be a trade option for certain teams. There might be some of those teams. I mean, we talked about the winger free agent market for players like Mike Hoffman is still unsigned. Tyler Toffoli leaves Vancouver, signs a free agent deal in Montreal that across the board, people thought, okay, that is a bit less than expected. With the arbitration system, it'll be interesting where Jake Virtanen's contract ends up if they get to that point. I just don't think that the trade market for Virtanen has populated in the way that I thought maybe we looked at a few weeks ago ahead of free agency and thought, okay, there's going to be a lot of teams that might be interested in a mid-20s center or mid-20s winger who still has some potential, was a high draft pick, et cetera, with some of those players that are still rumored to be out there or unsigned in the case of Mike Hoffman, who have much longer track records. And while they'll cost a little bit more and they'll come with a little bit more term, there's a little bit more certainty in what you're going to get.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting. Dan Murphy was on Sportsnet 960 in Calgary this week, and he dropped something that I hadn't heard yet and I still haven't seen reported. But if you know Murph, Murph always knows more than he says. And Murph sort of opined that he believed the Canucks had qualified Jake because Jake was part of the OEL deal that fell through. And the Canucks needed to retain Jake's rights, and they needed to still have him as an asset to include in the potential Oliver Ekman-Larsson trade. So I think that, I know for me, that kind of gave me a little bit of, you know, why did they do this? Why did they spend the money on Jake versus, you know, taking that money and maybe, you know, spending it on a Tyler Toffoli? So when, if you take that information, and then you also, the other thing that was of note this week was that a player in a similar situation, Andrew Mangiapane with the Calgary Flames, he was headed for arbitration and he signed a 2-year deal. I think it's about $2.45 million. And it's a fairly decent comparable for Jake Virtanen. So I know the number out there, you know, if he gets to arbitration, is the thought that he gets $3 million. There is a large belief that both Jake and the Canucks don't really want to get there. They'll probably sign a, you know, like a 2-year deal. But in saying that, you know, I think, you know, if you get Jake back at 2.45, I do think there might be some value. But unfortunately, the market has just dried up with Jake. And that's, it's dried up around the league for forwards. But what I would keep an eye on is I look at it as a potential, kind of like Cody Hodgson for Zach Cassian. You're going to probably trade him for a player that's not working else. Working out elsewhere that has some upside, kind of like Jake. Like if you were another team looking at Jake, you're thinking he's got all the tools. He should be better than he is. Maybe he just needs a change of scenery. And that's the only, in this marketplace, that's the only type of trade I could see, unless they throw him in as a sweetener to dump salary.
We have another question. This one coming from the text box. You can text this as always. We're live from 12 to 2 every Saturday. And you can text us at 650-650. Same number for the station. So 650-650. Here is one text. This will be the last one that we take here. Do you think the Canucks are trying to get some trade value early in the season by playing guys like Virtanen in the top six and hoping they get off to a quick start? Now, this is interesting in the context of the Canucks not adding more up front. And while we're seeing the potential for, we don't know what the Michael Ferland situation is going to be. I don't think anyone knows. There have been too many stops and starts at this point to have any expectations for what he may or may not be able to provide this team right now. But if the way that it looks right now, there is on paper, at least an opportunity for Jake Virtanen to get some extended run in the top six, whether that's playing on a line with Elias Pettersson and JT Miller. Otherwise, it's a bit more difficult to see him playing on a line with Bo Horvat and Tanner Pearson or whoever else would play with Bo Horvat, just because of the defensive boost that line gets. And that is something that his game still has not matured to that level. Could he benefit, and could the Canucks benefit long-term from putting him in a decent opportunity on a contract that is going to be, you know, much less than, say, Tyler Toffoli signed, and see if some of the potential clicks this year, he's able to score a few goals, and then there's maybe a trade market there for him going forward. I suppose that's an option. We've seen him get that opportunity before. It's going to be something that I think teams around the league are noodling with a little bit. When it comes to some of these younger players, some players that they might otherwise have given up on because of the reality of the cap right now.
Yeah, I don't think they're just going to give Jake away. And I, to answer this question, I would sort of refer to my last question in the sense that the reason they qualified Jake was because of his inclusion in this potential OEL deal. So when you know, if you factor that in, now they've got him. Can you use him as a piece to trade? For sure. I don't think there's much of a market right now. So to, you know, to the question that was submitted, I think the Canucks put him in the lineup next year unless they're able to find a deal. Hope that, you know, he's still only 24 years old. I know we keep having the conversation, you know, year after year, because, you know, I mean, he has not matured and he has not evolved as a player the way the Canucks would have expected or hoped. But at his age, I think that might be the only thing you can do other than giving him away for nothing. And as I said, unless you're going to trade him one for one with another player that, again, will probably have some warts on it and is sort of a project, much like Jake is, or unless he's deemed as a sweetener to take some salary. But as you can see right now across the league, there's not a lot moving. The only other thing I would add is, you know, there are still a number of really good restricted free agents that are out there. And I'm not suggesting that the Canucks would be in on them, but they may have a trickle-down effect on salaries. You've got Matthew Barzal in New York, Pierre-Luc Dubois. That's less of a concern just because of how much cap space they've cleared in Columbus. But we've talked about Mikhail Sergachev in Tampa, Jake DeBrusque, whose name has been out there a lot with Boston, and Rupe Hintz, who, you know, made it to the Stanley Cup final with Dallas. So those players are going to command quite a bit of money in their next deal. They're restricted, so they are off, you know, they're eligible for offer sheets. But I look at it more in a sense that once those players are signed, does that free up another player that's down their roster that, you know, those teams now cannot afford to keep? And does that provide an opportunity for the Canucks to fill out the remainder of their roster?
Yep, that's pretty much where this team is at right now. Market has been very quiet the last few days. And so we'll see if it just goes completely dormant or if there is going to be some of these unique opportunities. I'd like to thank everyone that sent in questions, whether it was through Twitter or through the text box. We don't know how often we're going to continue doing this, but we do enjoy the interaction. We enjoyed it a lot last week. So keep an eye out for that. Ask on air, and we'll take questions from the audience and try to answer them as best as we can. All right, coming up next, a conversation with Brian Burke, who had a long managerial career in the NHL, a big chunk of it right here in Vancouver. He's got a memoir out, Burke's Law. Apologies. He's Berkey 2020 on Twitter. The book is Burke's Law, and everyone calls him Berkey. But it is just out, a book co-authored with Stephen Brunt. And he covers a ton of stories about his life in hockey in a number of roles, from GM to player agent to working for the NHL. And he's been around. He's got a lot of stories, and he knows how to tell them. So we'll talk to Brian Burke next, right here on Air with Israel Fair and Alex Blair on the home of the Canucks, Sportsnet 650.
This is Sportsnet Today, and you're on air with Israel Fair and Alex Blair. Now here are your hosts, Israel and Alex.
On Air rolls on. Israel Fair, Alex Blair, Josh Elliott Wolf with us as well. We're excited for this. Brian Burke, who's been on the show with us before during the Canucks playoff run, has got a new book out, and it's a book about his life in hockey. Before we get to Brian, and he'll be with us momentarily, Alex, you've worked a little bit with Brian through some of your experiences working with Sportsnet, working with Hockey Night in Canada. What through this long life that Brian Burke has had in hockey, what was the most memorable part of some of your experiences working with Brian, with his role that he's had at Sportsnet, most recently as an analyst, but then also some of the work that I think partnered with him as well in the past, and also just coming across him while he was still working with the Calgary Flames, and you were at Hockey Night as well toward the end of his career.
Yeah, Brian and I didn't get to know each other until I was assigned kind of halfway through the Sedins, what turned out to be their final year. We were preparing as if it could be their final season. And having grown up in Vancouver, I knew what that meant to the city, what the Sedins had meant, especially to the fan base. And, you know, at Hockey Night, we started to brainstorm a bit of, you know, what could we do to kind of pay their careers justice? And the idea we came up with was to do sort of this essay piece, if you will. We had Ian McIntyre, who had covered the Sedins' entire career, write it. and we thought it was only appropriate to have Brian narrate it. And so that was sort of my first interaction with Brian. And if you've seen the piece, you can find it online. Brian voiced it in just like the perfect way. We had a chance to kind of work together since then at the draft that was in Vancouver a couple of years with the Sedins. And if the book is anything like spending time with Brian, he has lived a fascinating life in a number of different roles in a number of different NHL markets. And he's got just fascinating stories. So it should be a terrific read. And I'm really looking forward to reading it as well.
All right. Well, let's bring him in now. It's Brian Burke, a former Canucks general manager, on a number of NHL teams as well, and now currently working for Sportsnet, who has written a book co-authored with Stephen Brunt, Burke's Law, Life in Hockey. Thanks a lot for taking the time, Brian. How's it going?
Good, guys. Thanks for having me on.
Our pleasure. As Alex mentioned, we will probably get to the Sedins because that is a big part of the legacy that you left here in Vancouver. But we were interested in starting out with some of the inside knowledge on how this book came to be. Can you put us there? What's it like for Brian Burke to work on a book, write a book, and work with Stephen Brunt in ultimately publishing a book?
Well, Stephen Brunt did a great job writing the book. It is my voice. I think sometimes when a sports book is written by somebody else, the true author loses his voice. And I think Stephen told my story in his words, which were much more polished than mine. But it's my voice, and I was very happy with it. I think people really like it. I was very happy with the end product. But basically, I was approached by Stephen about doing a book after we won the Cup in 07, and I said no. I thought there was a lot of hockey ahead, and I was right. But I started keeping a diary after that. So the last year I was with Calgary, this would have been 2018, I think. In February, my boss, the late, great Ken King, came to see me. And we had made a deal when I went to Calgary that at the end of each season, we'd review it. And if I was unhappy, I could leave. And if they were unhappy, they could make me move on. And he said, I think it's time to move on. I think Brad Sullivan's ready to do this on his own. And they were right. And at the end of the year, we'll part ways. And I said, okay, that's the deal we made. That's fair. But all of a sudden, I was less involved in the decision-making. And so I had a little more time on my hands. So I started doing an outline. If I were going to write a book, here are the chapters, here are the key points. So I did about 100 pages, single-spaced. I hired a woman to type it for me and did about 100-page outline with some of the stories in it. And then Stephen used that as a kind of a template for the book. He looked at it and he said, this is garbage, but we'll use it as a skeleton of the book.
Brian, you've, as Israel touched on, you worked in a number of different markets on both sides of the border. Prior to that, you were an NHL agent. You've worked for the league. What was, in deciding what made the book versus what didn't make the book, I'm just wondering if there was any philosophy involved, how you determined the things to keep in and the things that ultimately landed on the editing room floor.
Well, not much ended up on the floor because I had a philosophy going in. Anything that happened that wasn't general common knowledge on the team at that time was exempt. Like a one-on-one meeting with a player, or a player discussing his situation or his ice time or his marital situation, that stuff's all, that's absolutely forbidden in my mind. So the test would be, if I'm going to tell a story about a problem with an owner or a coach, that had to have all been general knowledge with my team and with my management team. So there's no dirty secrets or no, you know, I don't like even the score books. I don't like books where someone tries to even the score with people. I think it's very balanced, but that was the test, is not to be mean, not to settle scores. And if you're going to tell a story that other people in the organization were aware of and would back up.
Now, before we get into some of the stuff that maybe pertains most to our audience in Vancouver, Brian, as Izzy mentioned, we've had a little bit of time to spend together, and I was hoping you could share with the audience the story. You were a shy kid growing up, and I'm wondering if you can talk about how your dad's job moved you around and sort of eventually led to you being a little bit more of an outspoken individual. But I also wanted you to touch on how you ended up at Harvard Law and the role that Lou Lamoriello played in that for you.
Well, I was a shy kid, and people will laugh at that, but I was a shy kid. I had braces. I wore glasses. I was tiny. like my first weigh-in at Providence College, I was 6'2". I haven't grown a centimeter since I was 18. I was 6'2", and I weighed 176 pounds. And when I graduated, I was still 6'2", and I weighed 206 pounds. So that was all just weight room and the work I did outside in the summer and all that. But we moved around a lot when I was a kid. So I was born in Providence, Rhode Island, ironically about 1,000 meters from where I went to college. And then we moved to Philadelphia, then Chicago, then Boston, then Minnesota. My dad kept getting promoted at the company he worked for. And it forces you, when you go to a new school and have to make friends, you can't be a shy kid. It forced me to open up a little bit. And then the law school story, I was a pretty very studious person, great student, great marks, and I was a history major. My plan was to get my master's in history and teach and coach at the college level. And my senior year, Lou called me in and said, you're writing this exam. Your professor's telling me if you do well on it, you can get into Harvard or Yale. I looked down at the LSAT, law school admissions test. And I shoved it back across the desk. I said, I have no interest in going to law school. And Lou shoved it back. He said, you don't understand. That was not a request. You're writing the exam. And I argued with him. He said, just write the exam. I said, I don't want to go to law school, coach. I got my future mapped out. He said, just write the exam. So I did, and I blew it away, and I got into Harvard, and I got into Georgetown. So my getting a law degree was directly responsible to Lou.
Brian Burke with us on air, Sportsnet 650, talking about his new book, Burke's Law, A Life in Hockey. As Alex mentioned, Brian, obviously we're doing the show here in Vancouver, and that's our audience. You spent a lot of time here. You have a very strong insight on what it's like to be in the eye of the storm when it comes to the Canucks. One thing that I was interested in, and I mean, you just talked about Lou Lamoriello, who's someone who's had a storied career in the game, and then the big reason that you ended up in Vancouver in the first place, Pat Quinn, another mentor of yours, a man that I was fortunate enough to spend a little bit of time with through his time with the Vancouver Giants. What I found most interesting, or when I look back at the history of the Vancouver Canucks, was when Pat came here and when you came here in the late 80s. This was a team that for the better part of 20 years didn't have much of an identity. They did make the cup final in 82, and they had some strong players in Stan Smeal, some character guys, and Thomas Gradin, a great player, but had not really established itself as an organization with culture. And that seemed to change quite quickly when Pat Quinn and yourself came on the scene here. What was the thinking with the two of you and the rest of the group taking over the Canucks and trying to build some sort of culture or organizational identity with the team and some of the players that you were able to bring aboard fairly quickly at that point?
Well, you mentioned me and Pat, but Pat was Batman. He was in charge. I was Robin. And Pat had a vision for a certain type of player. And we talk about character, and it's an overused word in sports, but we meant it. We talked about it like, this is the kind of guy we want to bring here, a guy that's coachable, a guy that will be active in the community, a guy that rally for his teammates. So we drafted, you know, for the very first draft, we took Rob Murphy. We didn't have a first-round pick. We took Rob Murphy. Great kid. Has worked in pro hockey for the last 15 years. Wonderful young man. Maybe didn't make it as well as the players we thought, but we got the right kind of guy. Stéphane Bayou. We tried to get character people, and Pat made it a trademark. When we drafted someone or traded for them, we wanted to find out as much as we could about their family and their values and their character. And so we did develop a culture. I think it started a little before we got there, because I think Stan Smeal was really a positive influence even before we got here. Stan Smeal was a marvelous, marvelous captain.
Brian, I wanted to ask you, I tried to do a little bit of digging about the book, and I came across a reference to a Gretzky trade from Edmonton to Vancouver that as assistant GM you nixed. I'm just wondering if you could expand upon it and tell us what you have in the book about it.
Well, I didn't. That was the headline. That headline came out. So Gretzky, the rumor was he was moving, and it got real legs that he was coming to Vancouver. And Pat said to me, he said, we got to stop this. We got to leak it out that he's not coming to Vancouver so fans aren't disappointed. So I gave the story to Gord Miller, who was a young reporter at that time from Red Deer. And he broke the story. But Pat wanted to make sure that our season ticket holders weren't disappointed. So you say I nixed the deal. It was more, Pat turning to me and saying, "Run the numbers on this, and can it make sense?" You know, you're not gonna say no to Wayne Gretzky. You know what a marvelous player, what a marvelous person. But the price tag didn't make sense for us. Like, it was like, okay, I would like a Tesla, but I can't afford a Tesla, so I drive a Ford, and I love my Ford. But that's what it was. Is we'd love Gretzky, but the price tag would have been Greg Adams and Kirk McLean, I think, and a couple of picks and a bunch of cash, and then we just. I ran the numbers. So you go back in the Pacific Coliseum. At the end of our first year there, I think lower bowl tickets were $28. And I think the price tag on Gretz for us was $25 million. And we had, I want to say we had 8 suites or 10 suites that stuck up on the end there in the one end. Well, there's no way we could recover that revenue, let alone make the hockey assets make sense. So I told Pat, I cannot recommend this trade. And Arthur Griffiths was great about it. He was all excited about Gretzky, but once we ran the numbers, he was supportive too. He said, no, we can't do this. So then we wanted to make sure we leaked it right away so our season ticket holders weren't disappointed.
Brian, one thing that, and Alex mentioned it off the top, that you'll forever be linked to the Sedin twins, and a lot of that, and there's a video out there that I love of you kind of bossing the draft floor at that draft in 99, making all those trades work to get those draft picks. What I'm curious about is over the course of the 20 years that have followed, as you stayed in the league and took on a variety of roles with different teams, whether it was in Vancouver, Anaheim, Toronto, Calgary, how much, and then we saw you working the draft as an analyst a couple of weeks ago. Is that still a part of the game, or is there still that ability to hit a draft floor and really make a mark as a general manager, or is there such a value on draft picks these days and the way that players and draft picks are assets and they're seen by organizations and by general managers as being hugely valuable, that what you managed to pull off in getting the Sedin twins players that, you know, have their numbers up in the rafters in this city now and provided enough memories for a lifetime for Canucks fans. Is that even something that is possible in the game today?
Well, a couple things. First off, thank you for the kind words, but keep in mind that was the worst first round in the history of the NHL. The reason we were able to do that is the first round that year, go look at it, and don't go out right after you eat. Go look at that first round. Like, there's terrible players in there. And the only reason we were able to make that deal is because the draft was terrible that year. The first round was awful. Second thing, and I never talk about the Twins without giving credit where credit is due. The guys that deserve credit for that deal are Thomas Gradin, who believed in the Twins long before I did, and Mark Crawford, who turned them into players. But to answer your question, is it possible? Yeah. The one bad side effect of that deal is it kind of killed deals on the floor. It was so lopsided in our favor that it kind of wiped out trade floor deals. You haven't seen any big ones. You see guys move back a couple spots this year, but no blockbusters because I think guys are genuinely afraid of the risk now, and they weren't back then.
I think the quality of that first round, Brian, almost makes the job that you did even bigger in sort of Canucks' eyes in hindsight. We were chatting earlier today. I think for the fan base, we have so many memories of you, and most of them are from press conferences or interviews, that type of thing. But they're quite selective. I'm wondering, through your two tours of duty in Vancouver, I'm wondering what are the sort of strongest memories or the things that you think of? And they don't necessarily have to be on the ice, but when you think of your time in Vancouver as a father, as a husband, as a general manager, as a citizen, what comes to mind about Vancouver for you?
Well, that's a big question. Okay, so let me step back. Point number one, I loved living in Vancouver. I was so sad when my contract wasn't renewed after 04. I believe that team was on the cusp of greatness. I loved the city. I loved the fans. I loved living there. And I was sick about having to move. And I'm grateful for my time there. I'm grateful for the way the fans treated me at that time. Our team got better every year when I worked for Pat. Our team got better every year when I ran the show. and people just jumped on board. They love the Canucks. They absolutely love them. So it was I have nothing but great memories about Vancouver. For me personally, my two younger children were both born there from my first marriage. And Marin, my 16-year-old, was born there. It's a special place for me. I became a Canadian citizen in Vancouver. I loved it. I loved everything about it. So in the book, I hope I conveyed that how much it meant to live and work in Vancouver, how fortunate I feel.
The other thing I wanted to ask you, Brian, and you're probably one of the few people that's sort of uniquely qualified for this, is the markets that you've worked in, and specifically north of the border. And I want to ask you sort of your opinion. We were chatting about it last week about, is it a coincidence that no Canadian team has won the Stanley Cup since 1993? And, you know, you've worked in the eye of the sort of national hockey storm, if you will, in Toronto. Vancouver's an intense market and sort of unique to itself. You've spent time in Calgary, but you've also worked in Hartford, the league office, and in Anaheim, which I sort of consider sort of a new sort of Sun Belt franchise. And I remember the 2007 year specifically, like when you guys won the cup and you faced Vancouver in the second round. I remember being sort of blown away at how relaxed your players seemed, you know, coming in for practice on off days in shorts and flip-flops with t-shirts. And I just wonder if you can speak to the effect in Canada and in markets, and does it have a real impact on players, coaches, GMs, sort of the pressure, if you will, day in, day out? Is it a coincidence that no team north of the border has won the cup since 93?
You guys, these questions are way too long and too complex. Number one, the reason a team hasn't won in Canada is because of the tax rates. It's that simple. Now, someone's going to figure it out, and someone's going to win a cup, but it's because of the tax differential. So when I ask my players for a no-trade list, a modified no-trade list, you get to pick eight teams you won't go to. The seven Canadian teams are on every single one of them, even on the Canadian kids list. And it breaks my heart. I say to these guys, well, why would you do that? Like, I told my players in Vancouver and Calgary, the years you play in Canada will be the most precious years of your careers. You'll look back on them so fondly. People love hockey. They love their team. But that's the main reason. The pressure is another thing. So, yeah, if you're talking about Vancouver's a great market. Most of the media are positive. Most of the fans are positive. But there's a lunatic fringe. There's no question about it, especially in social media. Like Jim Benning did a marvelous job last year. The team had a great year. And you listen to social media and they're talking about firing him. I'm like, are you kidding me? So Vancouver's weird. It's a weird market. It's a great market with this lunatic fringe. Toronto, the negativity is overwhelming just because of the size of the media. So if you're not playing well in Toronto, like in Calgary, we'd play a game on a Saturday night and there'd be 20, 25 people in the room from the media. In Toronto, that's 100 on a Saturday night. It's the original 16. If you're playing Montreal, it's over 100. And that's why when you look on TV and you see how big the dressing rooms are, they're not for the players. It's that big for the media. And in Toronto, there would be the whole room would be full of media. I remember sitting next to Freddie Anderson after a game one time, and he was in the end stall. Sorry, I'm outside here, and there's some traffic going by. He was in the end stall, and the press of media came about 2 feet away from us. There were 100 people in there. And so that's what's hard in Toronto is when you're struggling, there's 80 people throwing rocks or 100 people throwing rocks. In Calgary, it might be five. So it's a different market that way. But when you're playing well and you live in Canada, boy, it's special.
All right, this will be a quick one, Brian, to get you out on, and thanks a lot for joining us. For anyone who reads the book, what do you hope they take away from it or they might learn from reading your book?
Well, I hope they like it, first of all. I don't want to collect $20-something dollars for a book and then have someone throw it down and say, A, I didn't like it, or B, I didn't learn anything. I think people will learn things from writing the book. To me, I wanted to show people the challenges of being a GM. Dealing with players, dealing with coaches, dealing with owners, dealing with the league, dealing with your players. So I think people will find the inside stuff really informative and interesting, and I hope they do. As far as what people think of me, I think they'll see there's a side of me they didn't know, but if they don't take that away, I don't care. I'm not running for office. I didn't write the book to become popular, but I think people will see there's a side of me traveling to see my kids 2 weekends every month for 11 years, a side of me. Talk about Brendan's passing, my son that passed away. I think they'll see there's a side there they didn't know. And if they like me a little better, great. If they don't, never care, never will.
Well, I think people in Vancouver will care and will read. I look forward to picking it up and reading it myself. I know Alex does as well. And we thank you a lot for taking the time today, Brian, and discussing your life in hockey. You can find the book where books are sold. You can find it in ebook, I assume, as well. Thanks a lot, Brian.
Thanks, guys.
All right, Brian Burke, Sportsnet analyst, former Canucks general manager, who's lived a long and interesting life in hockey. We've got one more segment here on Air, and I think we're going to unpack sort of Brian Burke, his legacy in Vancouver, and some of the stories there that he told about his book and his career in the NHL. We'll do that next. This is On Air with Israel Fair and Alex Blair, and you're listening to the home of the Canucks, Sportsnet 650.
Sportsnet Today, and you're on air with Israel Fair and Alex Blair. Now here are your hosts, Israel and Alex.
Wrapping up On Air for another week, I'm Israel Fair here with Alex Blair and producer Josh Elliott Wolf. Just wrapped up a conversation with Brian Burke, who's on to promote his new book, Burke's Law. And he closed out. I asked him about what he hopes people might take away or might learn from this book. First and foremost, he said he hoped people liked it. And he got a couple texts in the inbox from some listeners who I think if they read the book will like it because they certainly like Brian Burke. This text in from Leaf hater Steve: Canucks' best move now would be to bring back Burke. He is president. He is one of the best hockey minds in the game. Also a text from Torgi and Langley: Brian Burke is a legend. When he speaks, I listen. Can't get enough Burkey. Alex, I think that pretty much says it all about a man who, over the course of 40 years in professional hockey and 30 years being a high-level executive, while polarizing at times, I think has, especially in this city, left a pretty strong legacy. In terms of on-ice things. I mean, we talked to him about the Sedins, but also just on a personal level of how he reached people and left his mark on this city and in the Canucks organization.
Yeah, he's not lionized as much as Pat Quinn, but I don't think in this market anyone ever will be.
I agree.
Yeah, but you look at sort of his first tour duty, and as he sort of acknowledged, he was the Robin to Quinn's Batman. And it was a little bit more, that was during Brian's sort of education of the business and GM role, if you will. But the period between when he left for the Hartford job and then worked for the league and his return in 98 was the Mike Keenan years, which were, you know, which was the sudden dark decline following the 94 run, which was at that point sort of the high point of the franchise. And, you know, he made, I mean, you touched on the Sedins, which everyone knows, but he brought Trevor Linden back. You know,
right
at that point, which, you know, somebody pointed out the other day that with the Jacob Markstrom deal, the Trevor Linden trade tree had finally come to an end.
Right.
You know, Brian McCabe, which had led to the Sedins, Todd Bertuzzi, which had led to Roberto Luongo, you know, and so on. But I've always sort of felt like that West Coast Express, I'm not sure they would have won a cup without solving the goaltending issue. And I don't foresee them being, you know, I don't think they were on the verge of solving that, if you will. But, you know, the Bertuzzi-Moore incident effectively ended that sort of run. You know, I know Bertuzzi kind of came back, but that team was never the same after that. I think it was March 8th, 2004. And, you know, when you look at that window between the first playoff run with that group, or sort of the first sort of, I think they got in 2001, but the Detroit series where they went up 2-0 in 2002, and then winning a round in 2003, eventually losing in game 7 to Minnesota, it felt like they were building. And then, you know, as anyone in Vancouver can tell you, it just felt like a sudden just end to that era. Yeah, and it was right, I think it was 2 days before the trade deadline as well, and sort of the immediate realization that, you know, I think everyone was still in shock because of what happened with Moore Bertuzzi, but also the sort of fact that you kind of realize that Todd, who was a huge part of the Canucks at that point, was probably not going to play another game that season. So we didn't get into it, but I know we've chatted at some points. I think We've talked at times about what could be some of the more fascinating subject matter for a 30 for 30 sort of style NHL piece. And I've always held the belief that the Moore Bertuzzi incident and sort of the story that kind of led to it and sort of tailed out of it would be fascinating to sort of unpack the culture of hockey and everything. But because of the lawsuits and legal sort of agreements, I'm not sure we'll ever get there. But I think it would be fascinating if people could speak honestly and speak on the record.
It would be. And the undercurrent there is the same thought that I had. As you were saying it, I was thinking it. It's not... It had a seismic effect on the Canucks in that core in the organization. Obviously, it had a significant effect on Steve Moore and his life, and it was used in a lot of ways as hockey having gone too far, and the game has changed, and those changes maybe weren't super obvious immediately coming out of that lockout that came a few months later. But now the game has changed completely away from that. And I mean, we talked in preparing to interview Brian about the fact that Marty McSorley, Donald Brashear was an incident that had happened just a couple of years earlier, right? You're looking at a situation there where that seemed like something that was normal in the NHL. And I don't think that there's no team in the NHL right now that is going to have sort of the wind taken out of its sails in a situation where there is such a devastating on-ice incident that traumatizes people and organizations. And is going to, that's just not a reality of the league right now. And I do think that is, I guess perhaps not. Perhaps it is part of the Brian Burke story. Seeing as he was the man in charge, as he told us, he was the one running the show. But it is, to me, he is a guy that, going back to his association with Pat Quinn, and to me, I look at the Canucks, and I'm glad that Brian. And this is one thing, part of the reason that Brian Burke is not as lionized as Pat Quinn, in part, this is not the only reason. Brian could be polarizing on his own, but he would not let that happen either. He was always going to be deferential to Pat Quinn. And as I mentioned in the interview, I did a little bit of work for the Vancouver Giants at this point 10 years ago when Pat Quinn was still alive. And any interaction I had with him, and you know, he was just around the team every so often, he commanded the respect of everybody that he came across. And I mean, Brian was absolutely going to continue to fuel that mythology himself. But I do think that the fact that he gave some credit to Stan Smeal, who really, I think that if you look at the history of this franchise, while for a generation, I guess your generation, Alex, Trevor Linden is Mr. Canuck. But if you go through the record books and you go through kind of the origin point, Stan Smeal really was the first person who he'd played a junior hockey locally. He had been drafted at the time when the team was not doing very much, right? Like it was a team that there would be celebrations if they happened to beat those dynastic Montreal Canadian teams in the 1970s. And they got Stan Smeal, who was nothing but a professional and a good player as well. And he still is associated with the organization. And there are some of these links that go throughout the history of this team. And both you and I were lucky enough to be in the building when the Sedins got their numbers lifted to the rafters. And we both observed how there were all these different links in that room that day. These are people that don't necessarily get along, that they definitely have different philosophies on how to build hockey teams. They've been in some battles in, you know, whether it's in on the ice or in front offices. I mean, you just look even at Ryan Kessler, for example. But all those people that were there, the general managers, the coaches, and the players as well, a lot of those links still exist to this day, and Brian Burke was there that day, and he is a big part of that legacy. And that was I mean, it's hard to believe that that happened this year, that that was in 2020. it feels like it was ages ago. But having some time to reflect on it now, it was a special, very special moment shared by a lot of people who had a lot to do with what this organization, what this franchise has aspired to be. Yes, it has not won a Stanley Cup, and that is a huge part of the story, whether that is Pat Quinn's story, Brian Burke's story, Mike Gillis's story, and at this point, Jim Benning's story. But these are all men, these are all people that, along with those players, and have tried their darndest. And there's no one that's going to accuse Brian Burke of not trying to put that together, and then also not having his principles. That's something that I think I expect in the book is a big part of it, right? I mean, he signed off his interview with us saying that he hopes that you like it. He hopes that he maybe comes off as sympathetic, but if you don't feel that way, then you know he doesn't care, because he can't do anything about it. He's a very principled man.
Yeah, one of the articles about the book is in the Globe and Mail this weekend, and there was a quote that stuck out that I had sort of written down, and especially with the last year that we've had, you know, within the NHL, but the NHL being a microcosm of sort of the globe right now in the world and every sort of issue that we're dealing with. Brian had told the Globe and Mail, quote, "It made me reflect on who I was and how I behaved." And, you know, it's a really interesting time, especially in media, for people that, you know, put themselves out there on a daily or weekly basis. And, you know, for someone like Brian, who is strong in his convictions and has opinions, I'm sure that it's been a challenging year at times, or one where he would have doubted himself a bit more, like, you know, and not wanting to just sort of, you know, just start verbally going on a, you know, on a tangent on air, not sure where it could end up. And yeah, that was, you know, he left the Canucks in better shape than when he had them. And I think in some ways, you know, we talked about Moore Bertuzzi, so it was a bit of a down ending. But in hindsight, when you look back, he left the Canucks in good shape and much better than when he took them over in 1998. I think Patrick Johnson in the Province had this week that 15 of the players that were on the 2011 team were products of either Brian Burke or Dave Nonis prior to sort of Mike Gillis coming in. So that sort of shows you, and a lot of them, obviously, you know, the Sedins, Ryan Kessler, Alex Edler, like they were, you know, Luongo was under Nonis, but the core of that team came from sort of the Burke Nonis regime, and Mike Gillis was able to come in and really push them forward in a way that, you know, to that point, Nonis and Burke had not been able to do.
We've touched on it before, and we asked Brian about it. We're both in agreement that there is something different when it comes to the Canadian teams, that the lack of success, and this is success purely defined by winning the Stanley Cup, because there have been teams that have come as close as you can get over the years. And that is, I think Vancouver is definitely at the top of that list among the Canadian teams because of how sustained that core group was and that team was. You have Edmonton's run. That was a bit of a one-off, and having Chris Pronger really changed the dynamic there, and losing him, and then all of a sudden the team was headed to the draft lottery for a bunch of years in a row. Those Ottawa Senators teams had a lot of talent, and they were able to get to one cup final, but they're definitely forgotten. They're not talked about, maybe it's because they're the Senators, but they're not looked at, they're not analyzed in the same way as that 2011 Vancouver Canucks team is. But I do think that the pressure and the expectations of, and also the business, I mean, Brian said it himself, that when you asked him that question, the first answer is tax and financially related. And as much as it's not a topic of conversation on a daily basis, like I feel it was in the 90s. And I mean, the first thing that pops into my head is the Vancouver Grizzlies and them leaving, right? because of the dollar. It's not something that we talk about nearly as much as we did back then, but it is seemingly an issue. Brian made the point there that that's another part of that discussion with these Canadian teams. And I don't know, what do you think has to change, or is there an approach that these teams have to take differently or account for something in that respect? That we've heard Mike Gillis talk about, that there are certain things that he would have done differently in that role to alleviate pressure from players or not create distractions, things like that. Brian talked about just the realities of being in Toronto, though we're looking at a Toronto team and run by Kyle Dubas, that they're definitely doing things kind of their own way. He's not persuaded or dissuaded from making moves based on the public, but it is a very interesting deep dive. And same, I mean, look, the Winnipeg Jets were a team people thought was on the rise. They've stalled out a bit. Same could be said about Calgary with these young cores, and there's expectations here now in Vancouver because of the quality of the young players here. It's going to be, it's just part of that discussion overall. How can a Canadian team actually pull through and push through and win this thing? Because we've seen the talent and we've seen some of those teams have those runs before. So it's not like the Canadian teams are all awful or are destined to be awful at all times. It's not like every Canadian team is the Edmonton Oilers. Now, there's been some losing, but it's not an impossibility. I think the biggest challenge is actually pushing through, and that is very hard to put your finger on, I think. What's holding them back, though? I do think it's a really interesting discussion.
Yeah, I'll respectfully disagree with Brian. I shouldn't say disagree with Brian, but I am a believer of the fact that it is tougher to win in Canada. And granted, I haven't worked for an NHL club and I haven't been on a roster. My perspective comes from living in both Vancouver and Toronto, working in the media markets there, seeing the realities that sort of behind the scenes to a degree that those teams are under that I know they're not under in the United States. I referenced 2007. I know that series for me was a bit of a light bulb moment. And you sort of talk about, you know, players are, you know, regular people too. And for the most part, most people see them arriving at the rink in their suit, you know, stepping on the ice, they look like superheroes. You know, we think of them as sort of almost a different class, you know, like that they would deal with these things normally. But I remember in that 07 playoff series in Anaheim, the Ducks coming in so relaxed, like almost like they hadn't thought of hockey for 48 hours. And they were coming to the rink and they were in flip-flops, shorts and t-shirts. And you sort of realize that when they leave the rink, for the most part, they're unrecognized in their community. They can go surfing in the morning, and they just looked more relaxed. And you know, during the Canucks playoff run, how much the intensity in that market ratchets up. And it's, I would imagine it's all consuming. Whether you're at the grocery store, people are pulling you aside. Can I get your picture? Can I get your autograph? Are you guys going to win tonight? It's just, it's nonstop. And they're regular people. And, you know, I know one of the ones that sort of solidified it for me was Kevin Bieksa was on the Spit and Chicklets podcast. I think it was within the last 6 months. And he acknowledged that during the 2011 run, he said the two games he wanted no part of playing. He said, I was in the worst mindset. Like, I just wanted the puck to drop and the game to be over. Was game 7 against Chicago in the first round and game 7 against the Bruins in the final. And I think we could safely acknowledge that maybe outside of the Sedins, Kevin Bieksa was wired about as well as you could be to play in a market like Vancouver. And when you hear him honestly reflecting on how he felt in those moments, you can see how the external pressure of an entire city starts to weigh on these players' shoulders. I am a big believer that it will be a bigger challenge. Not saying it's not going to happen, but I do think that Canadian teams have to deal with sort of a bigger hurdle to get over than when you see Anaheim get over. And I think it does trickle down to the GMs as well. And in the sense that, you know, if you look at the Pittsburgh Penguins, for example, Pittsburgh's not doing very well in the early 2000s. Well, if they're mediocre or sort of maybe getting into the playoffs, that's not going to generate a lot of attention in a market like Pittsburgh, where you have the Pirates and where the Steelers are king. So they're in a place where ownership says, no, like, we need to be extra relevant. We need to be a contender to make sense, like, to make a mark in this market. So they take it right down to the wood. They get first overall draft picks, which lead to Sidney Crosby, Marc-Andre Fleury, a second overall pick, which leads to Evgeny Malkin. And that sets them up. That allows them to be a perennial power in the NHL for the better part of 10, 15 years. When you look at a Canadian market, Vancouver's just gone through 5 years of, you know, and it was a long 5 years. And it wasn't necessarily by design. They reluctantly sort of backed their way into, quote unquote, the rebuild. But had they come off of 2011 and realized after the playoff exits in 2012 and 13 that this thing needed to be rebuilt and they went at it with an aggressive plan, you could have probably shortened that term and set the team up. But I don't think within the market, when there's that much money readily available, ownerships want to do that. And that's another, that's where it impacts the team at a player's level, an owner's level, a general manager's level. And I firmly believe that, that, you know, Canadian teams have to deal with that in hockey.
The thing that stands out to me from what you just said is the fact that there is a team like Pittsburgh or a team like Chicago. And I mean, Pittsburgh is, you know, a sports town, and Chicago is a sports town and a big market. And they had, you know, some ownership concerns, but also they were able, as you said, to break it all down. And they were rewarded with some high draft picks. And that has turned into three championships for both those franchises. Whereas in Canada, if the team is not in the mix, it's almost like fans would never admit this, because especially in this city where it's Stanley Cup or bust, because the team has never won it. But it's almost like there's this feeling that Canadian teams should be in the mix no matter what. And there's no excuse. And the salary cap is an impediment, but it's ignored because every Canadian team has the fans and has a fan base, and that the team owes it to those fans to be consistently competitive and contending for the playoffs. And look, if they catch lightning in a bottle, they can win the Stanley Cup. Whereas that is diametrically opposed to that idea that these teams can do that doubt rebuild. And as you said, Alex, in Vancouver, the last 5 years have been they've been long, but there is some hope, and it's generating excitement. Brian Burke said it: when this team is good, people get behind the team. They love this team. And look, we don't know when this next season is going to start, but or what it's going to look like. But whatever it does, I think Canucks fans will be ready to jump aboard. All right, that's it for us on air. We'll be back next week. I'm Israel Fair. Thanks to Alex Blair. Thanks to Josh Elliott Wolf. You're listening to the home of the Canucks, Sportsnet 650.